We're back with our alien guest and our panel of human experts.
Your fucking ocean is on fire.
It strikes us as suspicious that you're this concerned with our resources.
We don't even use water. We know you need water to survive, and it is both on fire and full of microscopic pieces of plastic. We can fix that. Your homes reflect light and heat in dangerously focused areas, creating fire. It's already so hot in here. We can fix this for you.
That's enough.
Stop hushing me. Look, even the stage is on fire.
Cut. They're being uncooperative. Are the other aliens prepped in the green room?
Krexorutions flying in.
Okay, thank you so much. You've been lovely. We're going to go with the Krexorutions.
They do want your water. They're gonna boil you all in it.
But they're very good in film.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane. It's
Locust Radio.
So welcome to Locust Radio episode 11, and I'm your host, Adam Turrell.
And I'm your host, Tish Turrell.
Our opening was based on a vignette from the Stink Ape Resurrection Primer entitled, We're Trying to Help You Motherfuckers, by Tish Turrell.
Today we have a few exciting things. Firstly, our guest, the artist Laura Fairschultz.
Laura was born in the 1960s in central Canada and has lived in Canada, the United States, and Germany.
We're going to discuss a number of things, but first, some updates.
We're starting to put together Locust 7, and it should go to the printer in early 2022.
So if you haven't subscribed, you should do so now. What are you doing with your life?
In the second half of today's show, we're also excited to have a reading by R. Faze of their piece from Locust Review 4, I Live an Hour from My Body.
To get to that half, you need to subscribe. So please visit locustreview.com to find out how, locustreview.com.
Also, just as a point of information, we are offering a special discounted holiday gift subscription rate for Locust Review for folks who live in Canada and the United States, and you can find that information on our website also. So welcome to Locust Radio, Laura. Good to have you here.
Ah, yeah, thank you. I'm really pleased to be here with you and Tish. Yeah.
Happy to have you. We wanted to start talking about your work, some of which is going to be in the next Locust, like I said, coming in early 2022. One of the pieces that struck me was Song of the Slow Capitalist Apocalypse, where there's this head with a tongue that's like a potato filled with eyes.
Yeah.
And in another piece, Locust Phenotype Plasticity, there's this evocation of the fluidity of form, which locusts do have, in which they change their bodies and chemistry when they swarm. A lot of your work is kind of open-ended portraiture or figuration, like in loose time, the dissociated dreaming.
Yeah, very much so. Everything that I do is very, I rely on associations. I don't often start out with an idea or a specific image that I want to do. I kind of let it suggest things to me as I'm creating the work. So it's in that way, it's very dreamlike, maybe a little surreal that way.
One of the things I think about is sort of like subjectivity, like on the edge, like the like almost like a single radically evolving figure, each iteration being at the same time totally unique, right?
Right.
And one of the things you talk about is like in your writing is the importance of mark making, going back to cave paintings, and how marks are tied to the importance of like unique individual people. So it's a central sense of self, but also this idea that you bring up of systematic dysmorphia. And I was hoping you could talk about that.
Yeah. Dysmorphia is something that I think that I've suffered with in my life. And I know a lot of people who have. I think it's obviously a systemic thing beyond just the individual kind of quote unquote responsibility of one's own place, but there are all of these things set in our culture, in our society, that make you feel inadequate, that focus on the way that you look, especially for women, focus on the way that they appear regardless of their content. And so it's no wonder that that women, you know, focus so much on the way that they look. It's acceptable for older men to marry very young women, but not the other way around. And if older women do go after younger men, they're cougars and they have to be very made up and you know, changed in the way that they look to look younger. So there's this long history of going back to the idea of the beauty pageant, the Judgment of Paris, right, where you have women who three goddesses who were judged, and of course the most beautiful was crowned, given the prize. So dysmorphia, systemic dysmorphia, dysmorphic disorder is something that you know, cisgender people feel. I know that there's a huge amount of it going on in the trans community, which obviously I can't speak to, not being trans, but just this idea that there's something wrong with you and that you start to obsess about it abnormally.
I was wondering, you know, your discussion on that, like, you're, because you follow up on, like, cisgender norms and how they relate to, like, discovering who you are, as you put it, and like, we were thinking that, you know, there are basically two ways to perform your face, right? A performance of becoming free and then the opposite. And I was wondering sort of what you mean when you discuss a feminized ontology.
Oh, yeah. Feminized ontology. This idea that things from the past come forward to haunt you. You know, everything having to do with the status of women, for example, when a woman gets married, her father gives her away. That goes all the way back to the time that women were property, daughters were property, and they would be given away to their husbands, who would be their new, you know, owners, so to speak. There are all of these things from the past that come forward to haunt women, and they spill into the present. I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and the double standards were just horrible for women in terms of sexuality. Like, boys could be free, but girls, you know, were either the slut or the, you know, the good girl. And it depended on how you looked, how you dressed, all of these things. So obsessions about the way women look is a hauntology. It's all through magazines and just general culture. I see it in the way, for example, I teach as an adjunct, and women are supposed to look professional, but they can never be professional enough looking. Men are professorial and women are teachers. There's always this idea about the way a woman appears defines who she is.
Yeah, you're definitely right.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure you see that in school and university all the time.
So how, when you're making your work, like the work you're doing, how do these concepts play with how you're responding in this intuitive way to the mark making that you're doing?
Well, I'll just go back a little bit. I think when I first started drawing, like a little kid, like so many people, artists who work, you know, you do it, you're excited, you love it. And then on the other hand, you start to notice how it gets you attention. Like, if you do something well, people pay attention to you. And that can be a real trap, for me anyway, where you start focusing on how well you can draw something or how well you can do something. Problem is, for me, that displaces content, that the piece of artwork becomes about technique or whatever, getting attention, especially if you're insecure at all. That's the way you go with that. But coming back to this idea of how this works, I think I stopped at one point in my in my development as an artist to say, you know, I can't have concerns about how other people look at my art, define my process, define how I make the art. I have to be able to put that aside and not let it interfere. So I stopped going away from strictly representational kinds of pieces of artwork, and I started going more towards abstracted things, which were great because you could put all of this gestural energy and all of this wonderful textures and marks and shapes and lines together and create this synergy. So when faces started creeping back into my artwork, I found that I was really torn between making a face that looked representational and making a face that I wanted to have some content to, because the content does, unfortunately, for a lot of artists, become about technique, what you can do, how well you can do something. So I found that I started destroying my pieces, scribbling over them, because I had such a wonderful experience with mark making and scribbling. And it just came together in my mind that this is very much, this dysmorphia has settled into the actual pieces, where not just projecting this dysmorphic disorder on myself, I'm projecting it onto the pieces, on the portraits themselves, and that I have to do things that on purpose mar them, on purpose create the kinds of anxiety that I'm afraid of, and just turn them back into more mark making pieces. And that very much helped me to open up more passion, or what's the word I want, more enthusiasm for what I was doing. And that's just the way that I work. And so things are very accidental in how the pieces come together. I don't know whether I'm doing a figure or I'm doing a face or I'm doing an animal. It just comes out as it comes out. And I've learned to follow it.
When you were talking, it made me think of some of the arguments from the mid-20th century Afro-Surrealists about how the concept of quality gets in the way of expression.
Yes.
And actually being able to say something. And also like the question of automatic writing or automatic drawing is the strategy to escape like an internalized capitalist realism. I know Tish has been writing in terms of their process about this question. And also the question, the old question in terms of abstraction, when is a piece done, right? How do you know when something is done or not? If it is ever done, maybe it isn't. It's a contingent process,
right.
Which I think is interesting because that's like working class life itself, right? It's never over, right?
No, it's never over.
You're constantly having to do something to deal with the contingencies placed upon you.
Like you'd never sit down and well, maybe you would, I don't know, sit down and write a poem about alliteration and rhyming couplets. I mean, it has to have some content to it that seeps out. Yeah. And I just feel like if I allow myself to step back and not necessarily predetermine what's going to come out, then content does come out unconsciously, and it is surrealistic in a way that it's dream or associative or unconscious cues. Yeah, like the potato tongue, the potato tongue on the song of the slow apocalypse, capitalist apocalypse. Potatoes are very symbolic, you know. My ancestors were orange men who came over to Canada as settlers. There's been a lot to unlearn, by the way, with that kind of heritage. And it's interesting that potatoes, I'm not really a potato person. I don't really like potatoes, but they come up in my artwork because they have eyes. I mean, how amazing is that? Exploding from their heads.
There, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Your sort of description about like sort of feeling like you were held back by expectations of other people, that reminds me of Well, it makes me think of the artist statement that I just had to write for my poetry portfolio, where I described like my process so far, which has been, you know, I sort of had my ability to create sucked out of me by external expectations. And more recently, I've been able to fall into automatic writing, which has given me more confidence in my writing because, one, the content is there that I didn't know it would be there unless I was able to consciously craft it. But also, like, it's really lit the fire in me of like, well, this was taken from me and everything that I had to do to get back to this point of being able to create again. Like, it lit a fire in me because then it was like, I'm able to create stories about what's been taken from other people. And it, like, it helps me see these things that have been taken from other people. So that was, I really appreciated your description.
Yeah, I think that's a fairly common thing. If you're, you know, seriously wanting to do this any kind of long term, like, at what point do other people's expectations come into this? And it's natural to want people to look at your work and appreciate it and understand it, but it can be such an addiction if it starts to take over your content. It starts to displace the kinds of things that you'd otherwise be exploring.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, because you're not authentically creating work. You're creating content for approval then. It's a different process. Yeah.
Right. And that comes back to that whole dysmorphic disorder thing. Like, visually, you're creating you're presenting or performing yourself to get approval. At what point does that just completely, you know, take you out of the picture?
Gut your actual self, right? Like, I think one of the things that I think is how trauma, as it's experienced by exploited and oppressed people, tends to limit our sense of being able to express ourselves. But on the other hand, that trauma is turned around, gutted of meaning and then commodified by other people. Like, one of the things, like, you talked about, like, in your review of Candyman for Imago, you know, I think this is, you know, it's not unrelated to feminized ontology, the aesthetics of blackness, where you wrote, blackness in the art world, a world long staked out by white protagonists, is obviously not neutral. And one of the things you discuss is the market for blackness separated from its social meaning in the emptiness of the art market, for example, in the Dana Schultz painting of Emmett Till, right? Where there's no sense of either the politics or the feeling that identifies subjectively with Emmett Till or Emmett Till's mother. It's this empty husk or whatever that's turned into like an aesthetic exercise, right?
Right. It's this whole... It's what Mark Fisher talks about when he talks about how modernism is just aestheticized. The revolutionary potential and meaning behind modernism is taken out. And I think I mentioned in that along that same quote was that the people who are buying Dana Schultz's artwork are extremely wealthy. Her artwork is extremely successful right now in the art world. Those are not the people who tomorrow are going to run out and campaign to get reparations paid to people in Flint and or African Americans or Native Americans anytime soon. So that's the consequences of that kind of capitalist realism, that kind of neoliberalism.
I was wondering if you could relate that too to something else that you talked about, and I think this is related to your work and your writing about artwork more generally. Mark Fisher's concept of magical voluntarism in psychology and psychiatry.
Okay, we want to go down this road because I have a lot of thoughts about psychiatry, psychology, in this time. You have psychiatrists who are not advocates for the economic dislocations of their patients. And systemically, that means that there are a lot of patients out there, you know, people who are suffering because of the economic situation that we're in, this neoliberal world that we live in. And it's like shooting fish in a barrel. They have their choice of all of the patients that they could possibly want. I remember asking a doctor once why he went into psychiatry, and he said, it's a good living. You know, it's, and it certainly is. But it's a little bit like not for psychiatry as a system, as an entity, to not look into the systemic causes of stress that are economic and the exploitation that people go through at work, for them not to look at that. It's like dentists not researching how sugar decays teeth. It's literally them having shares in candy factories. It's at some point it's a disingenuous. It's really, really disgusting. And it's a kind of cognitive dissonance on their part. They think that they're good people. They don't really think about what they should be doing, advocating on behalf of their patients. And so they engage in this magical voluntarism where they privatize stress, and the patient is completely responsible. You know, work hard and you will get better in therapy. And when they don't get better, it's you know, it's this whole is it Horatio Alger thing? You know, work hard and you'll succeed. It's extremely damning for the patient. So yeah, I have a lot of feelings about counseling, psychiatry, psychology. I have a lot of students who go to the psychological center here where I teach at the college, and they're a mess. And you know, they hand them all of this stuff about what they can do individually, breathing exercises and all this stuff. When these kids are worried about how they're going to pay their student loans back and how they're going to pay for school while working an extra job. Yeah, don't get me started, Adam, on that.
I'll get you started.
You'll get me started.
No. I mean, without incorporating the social dynamics into therapy and, you know, psychological help, you know, you're left with like a limited number of explanations for the situation the patient would be in, right?
Yeah.
Family trauma, personal failure, and chemical imbalance. I remember reading about the protests of Vietnam vets who would go to psychologists and psychiatrists at the VA hospitals after the Vietnam War because they had PTSD and they were traumatized because of the things they did for U.S. imperialism in Vietnam. And they would be told they didn't kill that peasant villager because of U.S. imperialism. They did it because their parents did something naughty to them or something when they were children or something, and individualized that trauma on them psychologically. I've been in and out of therapy for a couple decades, and it's been a 50-50 sort of like crapshoot whether you get someone who's going to blame you or somebody who's going to try to help you navigate the mess of contemporary life. And that's probably better than most people's experience. The worst experience I had was when I was broke and I went to the public clinic in Uptown in Chicago. And that's where I got blamed the most for my problems. They were all my fault. I wasn't facing reality and all that stuff. Interestingly, we've had 4 or 5 students die this semester at our university. And they sent out a mass email to everybody saying you should go to the student counseling services. And when that happened, the counseling services didn't have enough staff because they're like 3 or 4 counselors down from full staff. And so students have actually been protesting the fact they've been told to go to counseling for their emotional and psychological trauma, but there are no counselors available for them. So, yeah, anyway.
But there is a room with some emotional support dogs, so that's cool.
Yeah,
there are emotional support dogs at the Student Health Center, and after you get your flu shot, they will remind you that there are emotional support dogs that you can go pet. But I don't think that really solves much. as cute as the dogs are.
Yeah, as cute as they are. Yeah, we have this same problem here. Like, I don't know if you know, but the SUNY system, the State University of New York system, in Albany, they are going through all sorts of cost-cutting measures and thinking about closing certain campuses. And we did this thing on campus where we were looking at, because it's public, all of the records of how much people make are paid, our public record. And so we looked at how much we spent on police, policing the campus. And then we looked at how much we spend on counselors. And it's like they make a third to half of what the policemen make. And there aren't enough of them. So the system has a brutality to it. And it doesn't surprise me, although it saddens me, that to hear that, Adam, that you are blamed and that you get all of these subliminal, both explicit and implicit messages about how your recovery is up to you. And how do you attack or even take on something systemic that's so far beyond you individually when you're already sick?
Yeah, and you see it in multiple ways where, like, young people are blamed for the high rates of depression amongst younger people because they've spent too much time supposedly watching Netflix or watching TikTok videos rather than the constant social trauma of the last several decades. That's only been gotten worse. Like incoming freshmen, they didn't get to have their last 2 years of high school really, right? Because of the pandemic, right? They, you know, and then they have administrators telling them everything's normal, but it's not normal. There's millions of dead people. And that's on top of the economic situation and everything else. And that, I think, I'm curious, like, I think making work, like artwork, cultural work, self-expression in that context has even more importance in some ways, although it can maybe seems to some people, particularly in a capitalist realist society like the United States, that it's some kind of indulgence. It's just like a similar sort of like tack to, when you tell somebody you're an artist, they ask you what you really do for a living because that's, you know, and so on. But it seems like it's a, and I don't mean this in an art therapy kind of way, right? But in a way that it cuts against the utter valuelessness that is projected onto people, right? Individual people right now in this cruel, mean way. Like the anti-snowflake thing. Since when are we against people being unique? You know, like, when is that, you know, so, and I like that there's like a sort of explosive quality, in a number of your pieces, like Comrade Bomb, literally, or literally, and then the locust phenotype plasticity, which is like this locust that's smoking a pipe, and the pipe smoke is like a thought balloon bubble that ends in a hammer and sickle, right? So it's individual self-expression, but it's like weaponized in a way against, yeah, which I think is something really exciting about it.
Yeah. Well, the whole concept of phenotypic plasticity that you guys incidentally capitalize on is really great. I mean, this idea that when the conditions are right, the locusts turn from whatever they were doing before and en masse, they come together to revolutionize their circumstances, right? To change things in a massive, massive way. But yeah, I really like the symbol of the locust. By the way, yeah.
And they, in that process, they change too, right? Like
they do.
They become more of what they are in a sense.
They do. That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Well, you know, coming back to what you were talking about with the psychiatry and psychology, I used to think that when people could, like, for example, couldn't get disability benefits or couldn't see doctors because there weren't enough of them, that these were cracks in the system. But they're not, those cracks are there on purpose. That is the system. That's really important to realize because people are so underserved. I mean, look at how, forgive the use of the term crazy, but look at how crazy this country is. There's definitely a need for more mental health services to support people who are A, who are suffering, and to keep in check the kinds of delusional things that are going on in the right now.
I mean, I don't know how else to describe it colloquially. It's a profound level of social absurdism, right? Where, for example, like, and Tish knows way more about this because of Tish's research into the far right online. What are some of the latest? Can you give us the latest two insane conspiracy theories? And I say insane in a colloquial sense. I'm not trying to be ableist. I've been mentally ill for more than I've not been mentally ill in terms of being diagnosed. So,
I mean, I'm still floored by the fact that there are still people waiting down in Texas for JFK to reemerge. Like, they're still down there camping out because he's going to do it. He's going to be the next. I can't believe that.
Yeah.
Oh.
It's like a mass collective delusion.
Yeah. Then they're cultivating it all themselves. I've dipped out just for my own sanity because we're like right up on finals. I haven't really kept up too much. But yeah, I mean, I know that like Omicron is part of media control and you know, it's all still the flu and it's the same. It's just massively depressing.
I can't expand on it, but there was a part in Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism book where he talks about where people's research leads them further down the rabbit hole because of how selective things they are in what they look at and how the internet allows them to not be accosted by reason, right, or facts or other information.
I think the mass delusion thing is also connected to capitalist realism in the sense that we've talked about the realistic understanding of society that comes from the political center and bourgeois common sense is untenable and unbearable for people, and it's pushed some people towards revolutionary politics and you know, or creative, critical, realist artwork, and so on. But it's also pushed people, particularly from the squeezed white middle class, towards fascist and proto-fascist ideas. And so if you look at, like, some of the stuff that's come out about that shooter and Michigan's mother, like, some of it's unhinged right-wing fascist stuff, but some of it's actually correct, like her complaints about Common Core. In terms of, she's actually right about that. Common Core is terrible. Her appeals for Donald Trump to do something about it are absurd. But Common Core basically tortures children and undermines education, like real critical thinking in terms of education. So that people are reacting against something that's intolerable, and then partly conditioned by their class and race position, moving to the left or the right. And in the absence of a strong left-wing socialist understanding of what's gone wrong, it opens up even more people to these, I think, crazy, quote-unquote, delusions.
Yeah, exactly. Fisher also talks about, I like this phrase, the cynicism of compliance. And these people, at least, are not, they see that the system is rotten, and they're not complying. So by complaining about Common Core, at least they're not, you know, complying with it, whereas other people would just say, yes, it's rotten, but I'm doing it anyway. That's one thing that you see amongst these Trump people, that this very neoliberal cynicism, they pulled it back. And again, they come up with crazy ideas on that, but at least that's changed, that cynicism. It's still there towards the government, blaming the government for everything instead of blaming corporations, but at least they're trying to wiggle it or dismantle it or just challenge it in some way, like with the Common Core, like you say, questioning it.
Not to change the subject too much here.
Oh, go ahead.
But, So right before Red Wedge folded, you wrote a really good essay that didn't get enough attention on Marxism and art history. You talk about a number of important things, including, but not limited to, how minimizing Marxism and art history detaches art history from the material world and so on, how art becomes an instrument of finance, and how the art market is neither egalitarian or a meritocracy. And it also seems to me that one of the most insidious things it does is erase working class people, both as artists and as subjects in the art historically.
Right. Yeah. Oh, gosh, I got to get up. You know, I just turned 60 this year and I'm forgetting things. But yeah, I have to remember what I said in that article. Yes, exactly what you said, Tish. That's right. I have to think back to that article and what I should have reread it. Okay. So yeah, I see this all the time. Obviously, the textbooks that I've had to teach art history out of are just so terrible. They're the mainstream textbooks that everyone uses. A shit ton of money is made off of you know, their sales every year. And there's no Marxist analysis. There's no class analysis. There's nothing there. And it just all feeds into this art world that is about money. Let's, you know, no big secret there.
Well, I think that the erasure of working class people, Marxism, and radical black politics and so on from art history is not unrelated to the absence of a popular explanation for crises that causes people to reject the status quo for good or bad, right? Like, so one of the things you talk about in your article, for example, is how, like, in the mainstream art history textbooks, they have to recognize that Diego Rivera was a Marxist. Because it's so fucking obvious, right? Like, but then Frida Kahlo, who is also a Marxist, that's unmentioned, even though it's mentioned that she was probably a better artist and so on, although that's a subjective matter of opinion. And one of the things that strikes me, I've been doing some research on NFTs in the art world, and Frida Kahlo's childhood home is being turned into a series of NFTs in the metaverse. Literally at the Miami Art Week right now, there is a brick from Frida Kahlo's childhood home on display, and then information about how you can buy parts of the soon-to-be virtual metaverse iteration of Frida Kahlo's childhood home that will exist virtually or whatever. And I think that, I mean, on the one level, the level of absurdism goes, I mean, you might have seen that there was just a yacht, a virtual yacht, not an actual yacht, but a virtual yacht. It looks, people joke, like something from Minecraft, sold for $650,000 and so on. So at one level, it's this absurdism on absurdism. But on the other hand, it's this acceleration of the financialization aspect of the art market as well. And one of the things people don't see, I think, is they don't see themselves in art because they're not reflected in the interpretations of art, even though working class people and radical politics and Marxism and anarchism, these have all been central to like historic art movements and many important artists. And so it seems like this alien thing, and it's another way working class people are deprived of the full fruits of their cultural labor and their cultural history, right? Like, I think that's something you get at really well in that piece.
Oh, great. Good. Well, speaking of Frida Kahlo, one thing that I get visibly upset whenever I have to talk about it. But there's this photo of Theresa May wearing a Frida Kahlo bracelet. Yeah, like that just fries my mind. Like it should, you know, burn her skin given the politics. Political differences. And I remember reading, I never read the New Yorker, but I think it was in the New Yorker, there was an Alice Neal article, and they don't mention anything about her politics, which she, I think, either was a member of the Communist Party or was friends with or very close to it. It's a time where these things are being pulled, like references to Marxism, socialism, anarchism, all of these things are being pulled out of public awareness as a way to subsume them, as a way to defang them, to take away the revolutionary potential and just turn them purely into aesthetic statements. And I think it's actually a really good time to be a Marxist artist right now, just to declare yourself, because that's something that the stick is bent so far in the opposite direction of taking away references to Marx, even out of Dada and things like that, where it's just so obvious that it's there. And that to bend the stick the other direction and to say, look, I'm on the left, I'm a Marxist, I'm whatever, that becomes part of the art. It's a unique time. Everyone says everything's been done, but that's not really been done. This should be done right now for artists who are Marxists to declare themselves as such, because that's going to be an important historical aspect of what we do, if it ever makes it that far, if we're not suppressed or repressed or, you know, just written out. Or if
the world doesn't end.
Yeah, the world doesn't. Yeah, exactly. French fries. We'll all turn into French fries.
Yeah.
Because
potatoes.
Yeah. There you go. Potatoes. They're everywhere.
I mean,
they're everywhere.
I don't think you, at this point, making work that doesn't that ignores the vast majority of the human race or just superficially commodifies its existence seems empty. And I think, I don't know if inherently by form NFTs are evil or not, but the subject matter of most of them is banal and empty, and oftentimes sexist and so on. Stuff that you would think would not get past certain people in this day and age. And I mean, and it's similar in terms of the historical assessment about figures like Alice Neal. You rarely see anything about Alice Neal's connection to communists in the 30s and 40s. But you'll frequently see allusions to the problematic relationship she had with her kids. And not to say that that's not true, but you never, almost never see that kind of thing in an assessment of men who are artists who had problematic relationships with their kids, right? Or let alone the actual practice that Neil had, which was very much about focusing on the unique subjective personalities of the people around her as she saw it over decades, even when it was not marketable. Whatsoever, which is actually fairly impressive, considering.
Yeah, all things considered. Speaking of, just taking things aesthetically and taking out the significance of the work, have you seen that horrible film, The French Dispatch?
No.
The Wes Anderson? Yeah, it's literally a primer of style over content. It's separated into three sections. And the first section is literally this kind of parody of modernism, this art critic talking and everything about the style that she's espousing is just purely aesthetic. And then the second part is a parody of the French youth protests of the 1960s. And everything that they're protesting about in the film is just flippant. It's a non-issue. It's just nothing. And then the third section is this James Baldwin impersonator talking about this crazy story, but it has none of the things that James Baldwin would be engaged in and passionate about. So it's literally, if you read Mark Fisher, when he talks about postmodernism taking artwork and taking out the revolutionary potential of modernism, it is literally an example of that. It just made me sick watching it. I mean, he's visually, his films are interesting to look at, but it's really horrible. Like, this is just the antithesis of what it means to be making not just Marxist art, but why would Marxist art be important? It would be important because it's dealing with the suffering of humanity. It's dealing with the slavery of the working class. It's dealing with all of these issues that are real. And you're not seeing these real issues in film, a lot of films. You're not seeing these real issues in a lot of art. Like someone pees on a blanket and that's a piece of artwork. I mean, there's no meaning to a lot of these things that are commodified.
Yeah, I always think back to that Amira Baraka line about the politics of rich, from the politics of rich painters, about their fingerprints on glass being all that's needed for a proper ruling on art and humanity or whatever. So like the emptiness of like, I mean, Anderson's films, like even when there's content, it's like thoroughly middle class or bourgeois even, right? Like, so when they're, even when there's substance, it's very individualized and bourgeois. Speaking of class, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about being a adjunct art professor, because you've been one for a while.
Yeah, a long time. Yeah, I'm one of these casualties you read about when you read about on you know, Facebook sites dedicated to adjuncts. I'm one of these long sufferers.
Well, it's such a weird thing to do, right? Because I was an adjunct for a few years at the University of Nevada, teaching drawing and design courses, and it was both in some ways the best and worst job.
Yeah,
right. Because I love teaching the students. I'd have like between 70 and 80 a semester. I like teaching the material. I liked my students. You know, it was, UNLV is a diverse, you know, largely working class campus, and the pay wasn't great. But like the first year I was there, I actually kind of liked my boss. I had a rare thing where they had a dean brought in from another school, and, you know, they were an upfront, you know, kind of person where, like, if economically he was ordered to fire you, he would, but he would have brought you to his office and apologized and written you a recommendation letter anywhere you wanted, you know? So he was a boss, but he was honest and upfront. And they replaced him with this guy, who was a human tool, who's no longer there anymore. Now he's a dean somewhere else, you know, as it happens. And, he would bully people. They were talking about a thing that would never happen, building a new art building. And he asked, like, the instructors, and most of the instructors were adjuncts, what you would need for the sculpture department. And this adjunct, who had been there for 10 years, said, well, we need a loading dock, you know, for the sculptural materials, which is just obvious, right? This guy made fun of this guy for being, you know, the department chair made fun of my fellow instructor for being overweight, and started making fat jokes in front of him, like, if he lost weight, he wouldn't need a loading dock, as if being skinny helps you move a half ton of steel somewhere. You know, like, as if, you know, like, as he made people cry, he threw away property that belonged to the professors. And then, to kick it off, he took money away, scholarship money away from students, to create a bigger scholarship to lure more important people to campus. So he took money away from, like, mostly working class women, immigrants, you know, people of color, you know, to create this super scholarship fund. It was all bullshit and all about him getting his next fancy job. So it was infuriating. And here's the kicker. Anybody who criticized any of these things, you'd lose one of your classes for the next semester or more, you know? And so, like, to say you're targeted, you're at will, you have authority, but you have no power.
Right.
It's bizarre.
Yeah, it's a second class citizenship teaching as an adjunct, for sure. And the full-time people know it, and they have to make some sort of excuse for it in their minds. Some of them just ignore it. But it's real. When you're disposable, you know, if you've worked at an institution for more than 10 years, but you're still disposable semester to semester, I mean, and you don't really have benefits, that says something about how you are undervalued, obviously. Being an adjunct is terrible. There's something in New York State called the Taylor Law, and it's where if you're a public employee, you don't have the right to go on strike. And you can see that in the unions, the teachers' unions, that they're toothless. I'm a member of the union, but it's a toothless union. They're there to protect the processes, not the people, and take away a person's right to strike. I mean, what do they have left? I mean, it demoralizes tremendously. You don't really have an edge, a cutting edge. You're not Comrade Bomb, when you don't have the right to strike.
I'm looking at your drawings. I'm trying to pick one that doesn't have the right to strike.
I don't think I have that, anything like that in the ones that you're seeing. Yeah.
It's so disgusting that a law like that could exist, that just like it. I mean, I'm not saying that I'm surprised, of course, but it's just really, really like a punch to the gut. Disgusting.
It's disgusting. Isn't it disgusting?
Employees. It yeah. is. It's awful.
Yeah.
How could you like what I just, I mean, I know how, but you know, fuck.
And who signed that over? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And I know like one of the things about like how they've weakened the adjectification of higher education has weakened it in the face of right-wing attacks on education itself, right? Which is becoming a bigger and bigger deal right now in academia. So
neoliberalization of academia, business ontology. Run it like a business. Yeah. Well, there was some talk of closing down certain campuses, SUNY campuses, and someone suggested, well, you know, if you want to save money, why don't you get rid of some of the admin positions instead of getting rid of departments and things like that? And of course, no, that's...
Well, these administrators, they're like locusts in a bad way. They go from university, proving how much they can cut stuff. And they move on to another university, you know, we'll cut stuff and then add shiny things, right? Like, so you cut the actual funding for journals at the library. You don't renew tenure lines at a department after someone retires. But then you like build a $2 million esports arena in the student center, you know, because it's shiny and you can show it to people on tours, either alumni or incoming students' parents.
And stuff. Right. And it goes on the pamphlets that they send out to recruit people. And retention is everything. It's all a money game. You accept everyone because not that I'm against accepting everyone. I really would like certain institutions to have that open kind of a thing, but it's open for the wrong reasons. It's open to get their money.
Well, because it's not really open, because it's open to get you in there, but then they don't provide the students the help they need to stay there, right? Like, not really, because if they would, they would reduce the size of, like, for example, the English comp requirement classes to, like, 8 or 9 students, so the students could get individualized help they need. They would increase the pay of the adjuncts and grad students who usually teach those classes, or have them taught by professors. I mean, we were talking to my mom last night. Her English comp class was taught by a tenured professor, back in the '60s at a state school. You know?
Yeah, but that was the '60s, back when the rate of contingent workers wasn't 70%. Of the whole thing, and college was affordable. So I think it's all mysterious getting all of these loans that you really have no idea how bad it's going to be when you finish school and you're not able to get a good paying job and the loans come due. They have no idea. They really don't, not on a gut level.
And what does it mean to go into debt to get a degree when, you know, the climate news, everything, like, is there even a future? You know, I think the level of anxiety and depression is astronomical. I know I was glad when the students here started to get mad.
Yeah.
Because they should be mad.
In the 60s and 70s, I mean, we were all afraid of nuclear annihilation. But that would happen, I think, rather quickly. Here, it's this slow apocalypse where, you know, okay, so you're going to be bled out by the student loan. You're going to watch, you know, refugees and climate change going on and not, you know, have to pay rent and don't have enough money. Inflation is too high for the rate that I'm getting paid. All of that kind of stuff is just this slow eating of stress. And no wonder there's a proliferation of mental illnesses. I mean, why wouldn't there be? But that's not addressed by these well-paid psychiatrists who are there supposedly to help people.
Right. We're human beings are what, alpha predators? We're supposed to work 2 or 3 hours a day and spend the rest of the time just existing. And doing what we want. And
doing instead, what we want, yeah.
Instead, it's we're lucky if we get 2 to 3 hours of just existing.
One thing I would say about being an adjunct that's more depressing news is it's interesting how you know, you spend a lot of money to be qualified to do these jobs. Not only do they not pay you enough to have a living wage, they don't pay you enough to pay back what you put out to be qualified in the first place. So it's really cynical on the part of the HR and the admins to treat adjuncts this way, because you're not treating them as humans. One thing my son said that I thought was pretty good, and I don't know if he said it after he read something in Locust Review, but he said, "You notice, Mom, how when we're building robots, that they're essentially there to do the work of slaves. So we haven't gotten over slavery. It's still a desire that's there."
Well, robots were even sold that way in the 1960s as having your own slave.
So we've kind of touched on it a little bit already. There's like an all-out assault by the right wing on higher education and academic freedom, free speech. And there was stuff recently in Florida where professors were banned from like speaking to the courts on matters like voting rights and their effort to repeal tenure in South Carolina. And this is happening in the context that like 361 bills have been introduced in 47 states to rescue voting rights, and 19 states have passed 33 laws already to make it harder for people, especially Black people, people of color, working class people, to vote, basically. The bugaboo of critical race theory, a specific legal theory that the far right just like doesn't get. I mean, they have no idea what this thing is. It's that, but they're using it to like ban discussion of history and racism in public schools. Florida's basically creating a surveyed litmus test to make sure that professors aren't too left-wing. Henry Giroux, I'm probably saying that wrong, but I'm in French right now, so everything is pronounced correctly. Henry Giroux calls this an apartheid pedagogy, like in relationship to the curtailing of democratic rights, a sort of new electoral Jim Crow heralds a very real authoritarian threat. And we're academia, like you'd mentioned, not so weakened by neoliberalism's adjunctification, might be in a better place to like resist some of this stuff, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, at least in terms of content, I know I teach some pretty radical things, well, normal things in classrooms, and I, you know, can get away with it because they don't really pay that much attention to adjuncts, frankly. I remember reading something about Texas in, it was it 2012, where they didn't want questions about American history. Like, this is way before, you know, this latest round of CRT bans, because they didn't want students to question American history. They didn't want them to question the identity of America. And that's, I think, at the heart of it. They want these people to be fairly compliant and to respond to the same mythologies that have always been around so that they can manipulate them and manipulate their patriotism, basically.
I saw after 9/11, especially like how education shifted for people my age. And I know that it's only gotten worse.
Yeah, I remember 9/11. We were living on the border between Fort Erie, Canada, and Buffalo, New York. And when we had to cross over, because my husband was going to SUNY Buffalo, and the rooms were just full of Sikhs because they look different and they look, I don't know, dark. And yeah, just that whole change, huge sea change. Although still imperialistic and still just more open about who they've always been. racial profiling and mistrustful of other cultures and imperialist. In Canada, there was always a portrait of the Queen over the door that we'd have to go through. And I remember as a little kid, there's so much I've had to unlearn. Like I think I said this before, but you know, she was there and her skin was very pink and she was very clean and very motherly, matronly looking. And I remember looking around at the kids who were Native, like Indigenous students, the kids who were French, had dark hair. There wasn't a lot of ethnic diversity where I grew up, but I remember thinking as a kid, oh, my skin is pink like hers. Does that mean I'm more Canadian than the other kids around me? And there's just so much crap and shit that we teach children. Another thing I remember watching when I was really young with my brother, like 5 or 6, cowboy movies. And of course, the natives would always be the bad guys. And the first introduction to torture that I ever saw was some native scalping someone. So people I'd never even met before and wouldn't meet for several years, an entire group of people are colored by this this reference that, oh, these are people who do that kind of people. There's just so much to unlearn. And I'm so glad that there are a lot of people who are questioning these things.
I think that one of the things that's happening now with the far right is an overheating of the racist white middle class in a colonial settler society that has made itself wealthy or carved out some small amount of wealth, in part by collusion with imperialism, racism, slavery, stealing Native American lands, and can't accept the decline of the empire and the decline of their relative role within the global economic system. And there's some great stuff in, like, for example, Richard Hamilton's book of poetry about the foundational lies. You know, like the cherry tree and all that stuff, or the, what was the truth behind the limits or lies, depending on how you look at it, of the Enlightenment philosophies of the quote unquote founding fathers, and so on.
Yeah, but I love Richard Hamilton's work.
No, it's really good.
It's so good to have him in the collective.
Well, I think we should probably start to transition into the second half of the show. I know before we transition, I believe, Tish, you have a reading of something from Stink Ape, right? It's the one about the spirits being on strike.
Ah, yes. Okay, yes. So this is called The Body is Willing, but the Spirits are on Strike. Oak creaks in a frosty wind, broke windows glitter, eyes cry on my four faces, my spirits leak. There is no nourishment in derelict haunts. At night, I lured drunk teens into overgrown woods and fed their screams to my banshees. I haven't had a banshee in decades. All that creeps now, giggle whispering up my steps, or passers-by with shrieks like snack cakes. No ghosts can thrive on smoky cries of baked frat boys with fear like Pringles. I can't even satisfy the echoes of my first family. Without eating, they fade. I forget their smell.
This is the end of part one of our discussion. Part two is being held ransom by a machine entity whose master no longer remember how to control it. To liberate it and get a second hour of Locust Radio, go to patreon.com/locustreview and subscribe for $5 a month or more. Locust Radio is hosted by Tish Turrell, Adam Turrell, and Alexander Billett. It's produced by Drew Franzblau. That's me. Our music is by Omnia Soul.